During the last great drought, there wasn't much we could do on the farm, except feel sorry for ourselves, and so we decided that we'd cheer ourselves up, and we started collecting jokes. They became the Penguin Book of Australian Jokes, and to the amazement of both Penguin and the authors, the damn thing sold almost a million copies and became the first of about a dozen collections of jokes. We did kids' jokes, we did internet jokes. Add it all up and I've spent decades thinking, writing and theorising about jokes, laughter and the complexity of humour, even speculating on its evolutionary purpose. But now I've found someone of far greater knowledge and much greater depth of insight. I'm joined by Professor Jonathan Silvertown. Jonathan's an evolutionary ecologist at the University of Edinburgh and author of the little book I'm holding up to the microphone so everyone can see it, The Comedy of Errors, Why Evolution Made Us Laugh. Jonathan, welcome to our Little Wireless program, all the way from one of the capital cities of humour, of course, in Edinburgh with its wonderful festival.
Thank you so much, Philip. It's a pleasure to be with you. And yes, no comedy, not many laughs in Edinburgh this year, but generally, as you know, the Edinburgh Festival, Fringe Festival is host to about 3,000 performances of humour.
I've always loved going to it, actually. But now, are we hardwired to laugh?
In a sense, yes. A laugh is not just a human thing. It's actually found in most social mammals. So rats laugh. Unfortunately, we can't hear it. Or maybe fortunately, actually, there are so many rats around. We can't hear it. It's at 50 kilohertz. So they laugh above the range of human hearing. They don't tell jokes to each other, so far as we know. Their laughter is what's called a play vocalization. So what they're doing is they're squeaking to each other and going, I'm not attacking you, I'm just chasing for fun. Why do they need to do that? Well, because being social animals, they need to learn how to interact. And a play vocalization is kind of part of that.
But you make the point that young rats choose to spend time with adults that laugh more.
Yes, I mean, that's extraordinary. I love the fact that about a year ago, a German research group reported in the journal Science, which is one of the top journals in all of science, that they taught rats to play hide and seek, and that the rats, when they're taking the turn to hide, actually are quiet, and when they're seeking, they actually laugh. How you teach a rat to play hide and seek, I have no idea. Apparently it takes about 2 weeks. There you go.
Let's go back to human babies who, you know, tell me how you think laughter starts with us.
Well, it starts very early. I mean, it's clearly not something you need to be taught to do. I mean, even babies who lack sight and hearing will laugh. I think it's at about 4 weeks, something like that. Actually, a bit later. But, you know, laughter is hardwired. I mean, ethologists, people who study behavior, are usually very reluctant to say that things are hardwired. So often they turn out to have a major component that's learned.
But it's across all cultures, isn't it? And across all boundaries of language.
It absolutely is. I mean, you may not know be able to communicate with somebody in their language, but if they laugh, you absolutely know what's going on.
I remember many years ago standing in front of the gorilla's cage in the Dublin Zoo, and the gorilla was looking at me in a rather sort of menacing way, and very slowly it scooped together a pile of poo, its own poo, I hasten to add, which then kneaded into a ball about the size of a golf ball, and it threw it at me with unerring accuracy. Now, this is something that gorillas do because you tell us about Coco.
Yes, so Coco is a gorilla, sadly now dead, and she was taught she was taught American Sign Language. She lived in captivity, but actually in somebody's house for about 40 years. And She was taught something like 2,000 different signs. And it was an experiment in the sense that, well, it's a one-off, really. The people who kept her studied, her intelligence and so on, treated her as one of the family almost. And they reckoned that actually she had the sense of humour, in fact, the intelligence of a five-year-old. So we know what five-year-olds like. They like toilet humour. They like playing tricks on people. They like basic puns. And it seems as though she could do most of those things.
And she was a pretty good poo tosser.
Yes.
Now, psychologists have listened to people's conversations and discovered most laughter occurs in ordinary discourse and not just when someone says something funny.
Yes, that's true. And actually, I mean, if you think about it, if you the days, we don't know what's happening in Australia right now, but we're not allowed to go into cafes and laugh out loud. But, in the days when you could and the days to come when we are able to, you just listen. You just sit there and listen to people's conversation. And you can hear that there's much more laughter than jokes. And so this goes back to the whole thing about laughter being a play vocalization. It's being used in ordinary conversation to kind of oil, to lubricate the conversation, to keep it on track. I mean, of course, it generates good feelings in people if they're amongst others who laugh.
Well, that's evidenced by the fact that we laugh 30 times more with others than we do when we're on our own.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
What did Darwin have to say about laughter?
Well, this is it's fascinating that he had anything to say at all about laughter, actually. So, I mean, you mentioned that you yourself had considered the evolution of laughter. You're one of the few people who has. It's generally not thought of as something that, evolved. I mean, who thinks, about such things? So that was what's so interesting for me to write the book is finding out just how much one could explain. So Darwin wrote a book that was about the evolution of the emotions in animals and, as he put it, man, so humans. And there's a little bit about laughter, not much, but he says that laughter normally occurs under the following circumstances. This is just from memory. It's that people need to feel safe. You mustn't be in a kind of situation of threat of any kind. Surprise helps. People laugh at incongruity. In other words, things that kind of don't make sense. And the final comment he makes in this one paragraph is that among young people, you hear laughter all the time. Okay, so they're very prone to laugh. So that's actually a very interesting and typical of Darwin perceptive set of observations.
Jonathan, what did the sainted Sigmund Freud have to say?
I didn't know he'd been canonized. Well, he thought that laughter is all about catharsis. It's about kind of getting rid of all those anxieties and things. And the thing is, over the years, and when I say years, I mean 2,000 years, as far as we know, people have come up with all sorts of explanations of what humour is really about. What is it that really makes things funny? And Freud thought it was catharsis. You can see why he thought that. I mean, apart from the fact that he was invented psychoanalysis. I mean, that there is a cathartic element to laughter. You feel better after it, and so on.
I wrote a newspaper column quite recently where I argued that laughter is little acts of exorcism by which we deal with things that make us anxious or afraid. So he and I are on the same wavelength.
So I think it has that effect. But the thing is that laughter actually does so many different things that sorting out why it evolved, you've got to kind of get to the nub of it. The reason why I think catharsis isn't the explanation for why laughter evolved, although it can be cathartic, is that actually, if you think about it, if laughter was totally cathartic, if that's all there was to it, then after half an hour of joke telling, you'd be exhausted, right? I mean, if you watch the first, 15 minutes of a Marx Brothers movie, you wouldn't find the rest funny, would you? Because you'd have kind of done it, you'd have swept out all the anxieties, and you just be lying there kind of contented. But actually what happens is completely the reverse. You don't actually get less laughter as things go through. You get more. I mean, this is why comics have warm-ups, you know, have somebody come on and warm up the audience before. This is the, you know, the A-list comics get a B-list comic to come on first, do all the hard work of getting everybody in a good mood. Then they come on and they get laughter before they've even said anything.
Jonathan, you've just given me a great idea. We will have a warm-up comedian at the beginning of every edition of this program. It'll make my life much, much easier. Aristotle, he, like most of the Greeks, he thought that humour made people the butt of jokes.
Yes, he did. I mean, we you know, obviously, we don't know everything that Aristotle thought. A lot of his works were lost. And he did apparently write a book about laughter, which we don't have, or about humour, which we don't have. But it seems likely to me he did understand the importance of incongruity. But yes, he did say that the thing that really makes people laugh is, you know, when they're laughing at other people, when they're laughing at, you know, idiots, fat people, slaves, and so on. And of course, you still see that in humour today. So again, it's one of those ideas that has perhaps more than a grain of truth in it. But is it why it evolved? That's the question I keep coming back to.
Jonathan, it's interesting that self-deprecation in humour, which many of us deploy, also has has a butt, doesn't it? The butt being oneself.
Well, yes. I mean, you know, my favourite, there's a well-known comment from Bob Monkhouse. And he said, they all laughed when I said I wanted to be a comedian. They're not laughing now. And I mean, that is kind of, you know, the ultimate self-deprecatory joke. But as you say, I mean, many people use them. I like Arnold Brown's comment. He says, I do use self-deprecating humour, but I'm not very good at it. And you can just go on and on. So, yeah.
I'd like the way some theorists reckon the purpose of humour, or the evolutionary reason we laugh, is to fine-tune our minds to pick up incongruity.
Yes. So I think you're referring to a theory by three guys called Huntley, Dennett and Adams. And they wrote a book called Inside Jokes, Using Humour to Reverse Engineer the Mind. And I mean, it's a great idea that by analysing what we laugh at, you might be able to work out what's going on inside people's heads. Their theory was evolutionary. And they said, well, actually, laughter and all the reward, the endorphins that get released, that you get from laughter when the brain has spotted something wrong, an incongruity, is a kind of reward. You know, it's evolution has engineered this trick in our brains that rewards us for spotting errors. And why do you need to spot errors? Well, because errors are dangerous, right? Yeah. So, you know, if you don't see that there's a car hurtling towards you, then you know, you're a goner. So you can see how evolution might do that. But there's a problem with that hypothesis, which I can come to in a minute. Shall I go on?
Yes, please.
Okay, so the problem with their idea is that actually we only laugh, and Darwin observed this, as we just said, people only laugh in situations of safety, right? So if I make a terrible error and forget my wife's birthday, nobody, especially my wife, thinks this is funny. But it is an error. It doesn't cause laughter. But if I commit some strange, you know, verbal error in talking to you, people will laugh. So the problem with the hypothesis by Hurlitt, Dennett and Adams I just mentioned is that they're proposing that evolution created this mechanism that allows us to detect and rewards us for detecting error, but it only works in situations that don't really matter, that don't really affect our biological fitness, the likelihood that we're going to leave offspring. So again, it's another of those theories that has got a large part of the truth in there somewhere, but it just misses the mark. It doesn't really explain why evolution should have us do this.
It sometimes occurs to me, or I suspect, that one of the reasons we laugh is because we know we die. This great cosmic joke out yeah. there. And it is a defense, a defense mechanism against that.
So, yes, again, this is another of those psychological functions of humour, of which there are many. Yes, it is. I think you're right. But again, is that an evolutionary explanation, or is it really what we do with laughter having evolved it, right? It's a bit like saying legs are really useful for operating the pedals in your car. Okay, but they didn't evolve for that purpose, did they? We know that because they haven't been cars around for very long. So, you know, they evolved for running away or whatever. So I think some of the psychological functions of humour are similar. You know, having evolved it, it's useful to us in all kinds of ways. But you have to explain how it got going and how evolution shaped it, if you like, a long time ago, not just now.
I have to introduce another topic, and that is sex, because you believe evolution made us laugh because of it.
Basically, yes. So the hypothesis I mentioned earlier, that it's all about bug detection, it's as in not insects, but error detection. But then it's only trivial errors. So these are not errors that actually will threaten your survival, right? And evolution favors things that help us survive and reproduce. Crucially, and reproduce. If you don't reproduce, then you're an evolutionary dead end. So I argue in the book, and I think there's a lot of evidence for this, which we can go over if you like, that actually what humour is it's a sexual display. I mean, not as in you're waving your gonads around, but it's actually sexually selected. You're actually displaying your intelligence. I do recognise that this is a very self-serving thing for anybody to say, hey, look at me, I'm funny and I'm sexy. I'm not. But the point, I'm not talking individually, I'm talking about, you know, during evolutionary time. So the theory is that it's that humour is sexually selected, like a peacock's tail. You know, the peacock's tail that's so in male birds is so attractive to females. So it can work both ways. It doesn't have to be male to female. It can be female to male as well. And I think that is true of humour. And the first piece of evidence for this is that if you actually ask people what it is they're looking for in a partner. And this survey has been done across 50 different nationalities, so it's not as culture dependent as you might think. In the top three, you always get a good sense of humour or something along those lines. So people really want a life partner or a sexual partner, shall we say, who makes them laugh and who will listen and laugh at their jokes.
So, well, you've made me think. So that's, I think, a very good contribution to the program. This is LNL on Radio National. Download us whenever you can get your podcast or listen on the ABC app. And my guest was Jonathan Silvertown, Professor of Evolutionary Ecology at the University of Edinburgh and author of The Comedy of Error, Why Evolution Made Us Laugh. Thanks a lot, Jonathan.
Thank you very much, Philip.